Welcome to another edition of Making It in Movie Making, for what is probably going to be the most Yorkshire edition I will ever do. I'm Richard Fish, and today I'm talking to Liam Regan, who I'm going to meet right now. I guess let's open up. Tell me what you do. Tell the world who you are.
Hey, I'm Liam Regan. I'm a writer director. I've directed two movies in the past 8 years. I've worked for Troma for 10 years. I've begun a boutique Blu-ray label called Refuse Films. I work night shifts for a technical support company. So I kind of fit all that in the 24-hour period somehow. But that's me.
So you don't sleep?
I don't sleep, no. Sleep's overrated. Eating's overrated, you know? Film is forever, okay?
So as far as I can understand, like, because people are always like, okay, well, how can you balance pursuing a career in movie making if you're just, like, at a low level and not making a ton of money? As far as I understand, you've got a real job as well as all the movie making stuff. And the way you manage to balance that is you just don't sleep. So, like, your real job is when other people are sleeping.
Exactly. That's completely right. Yeah.
So is your, like, nighttime job full time and everything?
Yeah, man. It's like I work 12-hour shifts. You know, it's kind of like far on, far off. So, like, I'll work 4 nights, and then I've got to adjust to being up in the day, like now, on my days off, which can be kind of messed up. But I somehow kind of make it work.
All right. So are you from Rotherham?
Yeah, man, from Rotherham, yeah. So I work in Sheffield. If people's listened to this, that's the home of the Full Monty. If you've never heard of Sheffield, it's kind of near Manchester. And if you've never heard of Manchester, it's near London, which everyone knows where London is.
If you're American, it's near London. If you're from Europe, it's near Sheffield. And if you've never been to England, it's near Manchester. I think that's probably the safest one. I'm from Doncaster. And what's weird about this is Doncaster and Rotherham are right next to each other. Yet I had to move to America to hear about Liam. And so it's weird. And now I'm like, oh, there's this bloke. We're more or less the same age. I'm 38, about to be 39. I think I'm a tiny bit older than you. And it's like, oh, I feel like I should have met you at some point. I was looking at our Facebooks and we got so many kind of crossover people in common, like ways we could have met, but never have. So
that's strange.
It is weird, yeah.
I used to go out in Doncaster a lot when I used to drink, like, you know, my early 20s. I used to go to, like, the Trilogy nightclub.
I worked at the Trilogy at one point.
Wow, that's funny. Yeah, I think it was like on a Tuesday night where they used to play like rock songs and shit. Yeah, man, it was cool.
That's so weird. But it's like, I was looking, like, IMDb stalking you, like you do. And it seems like you kind of went, I want to make movies. And then you ended up almost immediately doing stuff for Troma. How does that happen?
Yeah, so like I went to Barnsley College and I did media studies and moving image and all that kind of stuff. And then I got a real job at a call center, but the dream was always to make movies. Quit drinking in like 2009, that kind of helped. So when I quit drinking, when I stopped the party lifestyle and being in bands and stuff, I started to go to coffee shops. And what do you do when you go to a coffee shop? You take books. So I started like reading a screenplay by Sid Field and Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, the screenwriting books, to kind of like learn how to create a feature length screenplay, you know, with the character arcs and acts and, you know, because I wanted to make my own movie. Now, I've made short films in college. I'd say the like seminal moment, the turning point, was I went to see a band called Jimmy Eat World in 2011 with my girlfriend at the time. And then that night we had unprotected sex. It was great. However, there was like an internal pop. And when I pulled out, there was blood all over the place. Ooh. And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, fuck, are you on a period or something? And it turns out she wasn't on a period. And she's like, oh, you've snapped your banjo string. And I didn't even know what that meant at the time. And obviously, it means when you rip the frenulum on the penis. Mm. So that kind of inspired this idea to write a short film called Banjo. And then that was in 2012. It played Troma Dance Film Festival in 2013. And the response was that it was a really fucked up short film. So I thought, well, would it be
I'm
would
gonna
it
be
not be
honest,
fucked?
I've not seen
Yeah.
it. It doesn't sound all that kind of, family friendly. But I love the fact that this horrific thing happened to you. They say, write what you know, and you're like, all right.
Yeah, I just and plus, it was a way to like it was a way to kind of like get over my ex at the time. So yeah, it was very therapeutic. And I decided to make it into a film because I was studying these screenwriting books. I was like, well, maybe I can add these characters to this new story. And then I worked a lot of overtime hours at work. I worked when I was working day shift.
Is
So I
the
was
call
working like
center
six
still?
call center, yeah, man. So I was like working 16-hour days, and
Jesus.
I did it like the Kevin Smith way as well. I maxed out credit cards, and I were able to make My Bloody Bang during the summer of 2014 for 15 grand. It cost me 15 grand. Now I'm kind of jumping all over the place here, so you'll have to rein
No,
me in.
it's
But
all right. This
two,
is how brains work. So there's 15 grand
yeah.
on a. How long's the short? Because I've only seen your one movie. So how long's the banjo short?
So the short film cost me like a grand, probably a grand to make, and it's like 17 minutes. And then in 2014, we made the feature, which is like 94 minutes, and that cost 15 grand. But 2 years prior to that, I flew over to Buffalo, Niagara, to work on Return to Nuke 'Em High, because I've been a lifelong Troma fan since I was 11 years old. And then when Lloyd was saying that they're making a movie that summer, I decided just to get on a plane by myself and then sleep on the floor of an abandoned funeral home with like 60 other people and one shower. And yeah, it was, I was sober at the time. I was getting my shit together. I just wanted to do all the things that 11-year-old Liam wanted to do.
That's so cool. So how, but I mean, how did you get yourself that in with trauma? Did you just like stalk them, or like, how did you?
So like I've been emailing Lloyd for years because I've been a huge fan, and
Just
Lloyd's very
out of
responsive.
nowhere, you just like found his email and just was like, go for it. I mean, like, how did you?
Yeah, pretty much, man. Yeah, I mean, Lloyd at trauma.com. It's he's a very kind of like accessible guy for to especially on social media as well. But I just emailed him and just said, look, I'm a big fan. If you're ever in England, if you need any help at the conventions or whatever, just let me know. And he used to come over a lot at the Prince Charles Cinema in London. So I actually met him for the first time in 2002 because they came over to Leicester, and that was awesome. And yeah, so I've just kind of like remained in contact with Lloyd. And then when he was able to make another movie in 2012, I just jumped at the chance.
That's exciting. So he did that in 2012. He was just like, come along, as he did.
Yeah, dude, I just went along as like a production assistant, and I flew over, obviously it's unpaid work and everything, but to me that was like film school.
This is
I
all
learned
credit cards
how
as well.
what to fly over there. I mean, fly over there, I was in debt in that time anyway, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, what's 5 grand in debt versus 10 grand in debt? It's the same fucking thing. You're in debt. So, but work gave me time off, which was really good. And I learned a lot on that film set, and I met a lot of lifelong friends that I still work with to this day, 10 years later, which is cool.
That is cool. And it's I can't remember how you even came up in conversation. Someone's like, do you know Liam? I'm like, how do I not know him? Because we kind of got like similar things going on. And like when I watched your Mrs. Campbell, what's it called?
Eating Miss Campbell.
Eating Miss Campbell. Like I watch it and I'm like, oh, I know Paris. You know what I mean? It's just like little people pop up and it's kind
Yeah,
of
it's
like.
a very incestuous community, like the British film scene, right? Scene, the
Yeah,
indie scene. Yeah.
I did see this pretty this sincest, and I was like, that's clever, but I can see how it might like upset people.
Yeah, well,
Oh.
I changed. That was when I was being an edgy 26-year-old, but now when I'm an edgy 38-year-old, I'm like, nah, we need to be a bit more classier,
See, I've been playing it safe for far too long because I try and make stuff for no money, and then it looks like I made stuff with no money. So I've never had like debt. But the thing that I've also never been wealthy because the thing I will do is quit jobs without batting an eyelid. It's like, I need some time off. Can I have some time off? No. All right. Well, I'm taking some. So.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just got to jump into it. I mean, like, ideally, the normal thing is you make maybe 5 years of short films, and then those short films you'd show to a producer or an investor to get money for a proof of concept, and that proof of concept would then become a feature. Or, there's certain ways, like, there's like kind of like a guideline to go in. I wasn't prepared to make Banjo after making one short film. Like, I made projects in college, obviously, but I made one short film in 2012, and I decided to make a feature in 2014. And to me, that's the only way to kind of do it, in my opinion, is because you're learning on the go, and you'll never, to me, it's like film school is great, and I studied at college and everything, moving image. But unless you're on set dealing with that shit and going through, because making films is really hard. Like, I wanted to blow my brains out so much on Banjo, and there's a making of a documentary on the Blu-ray, and I look like hell. Like, I'm having such a miserable time. There's so much of me clashing with the DP, but that's how indie films are made, because there's not enough hours in the day, and you're green, and everyone else you're working with is green, and everyone's non-union. So it's essentially you're trying to get people on board, like-minded people, to see your vision and collaborate, because it's a collaborative process. It's like, so Eat Miss Campbell was a better experience than Banjo, which means that the Eat Miss Campbell making of documentary won't be as entertaining as the banjo one. So much drama in the banjo one. Like, yeah,
I've
it's
got
worth
a lot of
watching.
threads to kind of go from here. I think I'm going to kind of sidetrack a bit and ask you about these Blu-rays and DVDs because I looked on your website and they look amazing. These like collector's edition things that you're putting together. And you say you've got your own Blu-ray distribution. So is this like you working with a company or have you got all of this like infrastructure to make these kind of special edition
So yeah, I mean, it's all
things?
in-house. So I mean, it's just me. And then I, like, for example, if I need artwork done, I'll pay an artist to put together a Blu-ray cover. And then to get the discs replicated, I mean, the factory press, so they're like professionally done, just like the ones that you could buy in the stores or Amazon. So like, I'll order 1,000 units of Banjo, because that's the lowest amount that you can
Yeah.
order. And yeah, I mean, it's I've sold half the units currently, which is really good. In like 5 6 weeks it's been on sale, which is really impressive. And
Is this
bringing that
fully
in,
pressed with your art and the case and everything, like they do it for you, or just the discs?
oh, okay, so it's like, so I send all the elements to a post house with that author of the Blu-ray, so they create the
Yeah.
menu and everything, and then
Oh,
they
cool.
send that off to a replicator. So, for example, I'll say, look, I want a matte slip cover, 11 millimeter Blu-ray case, but in black. And I want to inlay in there. And you send them
Yeah.
the graphics and everything. I mean, they send you the templates, you send them the graphics, then they send you a quote, you pay the invoice, and then it takes about 3 weeks to get made. I think it's somewhere in Europe, because then they're going to ship them back to the UK. And then yeah, like, it's just me, really, just packing up the Blu-rays. If someone orders one, pack it up, send it to the post office. Post office hates me because I come in with like fucking bags of Blu-rays, and then the people in, queuing up behind me fucking give me, I can feel that they give me an evil stare at the back, but I
Yeah,
get
because you got
it at the
like
same
set
time.
going to like 20 different addresses, and there's like another one, and another one, and another one.
Well, yeah, it's not even that. It's like when it's international, it takes even longer, man.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's crazy, but it's nice. It's nice when people receive them, and then they say they like the film or whatever. It's always worth it. It's To me, that's the whole thing, is entertaining people. I mean, if you can financially make money from that, then that's amazing. Because I signed, so in 2016, I signed with a really bad distributor for Banjo, and they they promised me so much for the film, the release. Like, they said they're going to put it in Walmart and everything, because in 2016, that's pretty much, Walmart was like the only place to get physical media these days,
Yeah.
apart from online. And it was like, that's a big thing. And then they just dumped it on Amazon, like, digitally, and like did this made on demand DVD, which is like kind of a DVD-R that they send out upon,
That's not
like,
great.
like a no, a made for order. I didn't include any of the deliverables, the special features I sent them. So I had to then, it sounds fucked up this bit, but I had to buy back the rights to Banjo so I could sell it in the UK. So, because I was stupid enough
So do they still have
excuse
the
me.
rest of the world for your movie?
For another three, for another two years, for another 2 or 3 years, yeah.
Keep going, but it's amazing how many people I've spoken to that say they got shafted by distributors. So keep
Oh,
telling me.
yeah, sure. So yeah, I mean, I was silly enough to sign a 10-year license. Gave them worldwide rights and everything. Because at the end of the day, you're a filmmaker and you make you feel, and you believe what people in the industry tell you because you think that they've got your best interests at heart, but they really don't. All they want is a title to own. That to license, sorry, to then sell as let's say a 50 pack of different movies to a different territory in the world to get an upfront sum, and they bury you in expenses. So I've stopped getting sales reports for some reason, but I used to get a sales report every 6 months, and they'll say that, well, it's cost us let's say 30 grand in like marketing, in like lab fees, even though it's a digital export that I sent them. Loads of bullshit. And then whenever the movie makes money, they bury you so much in expenses that they're always taken from that pot because these expenses are fabricated for the most part. So, and to be honest with you, dude, it's like that's why there's so many filmmakers that never get to make a second film. I think the BFI, I think the BFI a few years ago did a statistic where I think it was something like indie filmmakers, this is like only 3% of indie filmmakers get to make a second movie, and that's a really depressing statistic. And because I lost all my money on Banjo, it took so long to save up money again to do Eat and Miss Campbell. But not just that, just having the confidence to do it again, because Banjo had this great festival run where my first movie, it played it premiered at Fright Fest in London, and then it played all over the world, and it yeah I'm like, oh cool. And I just thought that distributor would really push the DVD release, but no, they didn't. So, that kind of killed my confidence and it killed my love for filmmaking. I didn't even promote that the American release. So, it took a long time to re-edit the film from scratch to some like because the film I felt was rushed in post-production. I had me and the post-production people like butted heads a lot, which you'll see in the documentary if you ever watch it.
So I'm going to forget one second. So you didn't do the editing yourself originally, like on
No.
the first version
Oh
of
no.
Premiere.
No, I mean I'm not an editor. I edited the short film, but I'm really not an editor. So
Let's talk about
like
crew then. So you say you spent 15 grand on this movie. Like, how many people is that? Like, what are you paying for? Because I know there's probably locations and stuff. Because me, I'm always like, okay, I write as cheap as possible. It's like, oh, I need a no, don't do that. Tell you what, I'll rewrite it. Where like I feel like I
Yeah,
need to kind of I feel like there's a happy balance somewhere between where we're at. So I want to know like what the credit card spending went on.
sure, man. Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I would only say like if we talk about crew, let's say if we had like 20 to 30 people, I'd probably say under 10 of them got paid, and then everyone else kind of did it voluntarily because, if you're going to pay every single person on a movie, I mean, you won't be able to make it for that price. So to me, it's like you need a camera crew, you need a professional camera crew, or camera crew that's filmed things before, and then they have like an AC, and they have like a data management team that digitize the actual footage, and then so like I think they're called data managers. So let's say your camera crew is like 4 or 5 people because you need like grips and lighting and all that kind of stuff. Then you got your special effects guy that you need to pay, especially if you're making a genre horror film. So your special effects guy you pay, sound guy definitely because sound is so important. I always say sound's like 65% of your film. If there's a few things that people will forgive you on when they watch an independent movie, but they'll never forgive bad acting and bad sound. If you've got good acting and good sound and it looks like shit, you can still get away with it, So those are the two most important, in my opinion,
No,
for what
I
it's
think you're
worth.
right, and I think there's this isn't a this is an aside, but like there's far too much like mystique around the cameras. Need something Netflix approved. There's a lot of it. So it's got to be 4K, got to be 6K, got to be like 8K. Or I'm like, look, the cinema projects in basically full HD. Doesn't matter.
Completely. No, without a doubt. And to me, it's like, that full resolution, it's kind of bullshit in a way. It really is, because to me, you can shoot a film on mini DV, you can shoot the film on whatever. I mean, to be fair, when I went to college, we had mini DV cameras. And to me, looking back at that camera now, it looks more exciting than watching something on a pristine 4K digital camera, because at least DV has some kind of, it has its own identity. Where now everything is just so kind of clean and rich, and to me it's like, I've always wanted to shoot on Super 16 millimeter film, because a lot of my favorite movies, they have that rawness, that grittiness, and
I
it's
agree.
and the thing with digital as well, all digital is doing is replicating what film looks like. So I mean,
And
I would
there's
love
an
to shoot.
obsession with this like shallow depth of field. Like ever since we got all these DSLR lenses, like, oh, I can make anything look cinematic. It's like, yes, but there are times when you don't want that. You know, that's an
No.
aesthetic choice. And sometimes you want to be able to focus on stuff in the background as like it's kind of just come on.
I
Oh,
know.
and anyway, yeah.
I completely agree. And what I've also found as well, there's so many indie horror films that want to shoot in 2:35, they want to kind of like really. And to me, it's like, really? Because like most of the genre films I watch are like 69, 185. They are just in standard widescreen format. And like, it's like, unless you've got the budget to really fill out the frame and everything, it's just going to make it look kind of, because you're not John Carpenter that can fill a frame. To me, you need to have an eye. And I just think, just shooting it that way exposes you more. And to me, it should really be, especially independent films, focus on the character, focus on the story, and let that kind of like, and have your own identity as well, and have your own look, and have your own kind of, and for me, with independent filmmaking, I think it's important to stand out. Like, I see so many indie filmmakers trying to replicate what the studio system's doing. Like, they'll play, like, they'll do a straight exorcism film, like a drama, like, and it's like, dude, I've seen so many of them. Exorcist did it really well, but I also feel like a lot of films take themselves too fucking seriously, right?
I
I feel
completely
like,
agree.
yeah.
So you go to a film festival, and it's really annoying because a lot of the films that, I mean, this is probably just me being a snob or whatever, but like a lot of the films that win the prizes, they just choose the films that have the best technicians. It's like, oh, this one looked nice, this one sounded good. And I'm like, it was boring as shit. And yet everyone's
Right.
like the, and even when the people can't act, it's like, oh, it looks pretty and it's great and I'm going to give it this prize. And then you get something else that maybe somebody made on a phone. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it's like, oh, that was really good and original and quirky. And they do stand out. I mean, there's things that obviously, you know, get exposure. Like I've forgotten the name of that one that they filmed on Zoom that was like an hour long host. That was kind of cool.
Host, yeah.
And I like stuff like that. But the amount of times you'll go to a film festival and it's like, it's a copy of a film that exists. It's like another zombie film, but it's not like a zombie film that's doing something different with zombies. It's trying to be Dawn of the Dead or it's trying to be Shaun of the Dead. And it's like if you're going to copy a film that already exists, what's the point? Because you don't have the
What's the
budget.
point?
And the thing you're
Exactly.
copying is going to be better.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. And you're not going to stand out anyway. You're just going to be, it's like, why would I want to get Kellogg? No, so why would I want to get, like, let's say, Tesco branded cornflakes when Kellogg's are at the same price? Right? Like, to me, it's like, and to me, you need to stand out. And also, if you're a writer director, you need to have your own voice. You need to have your own kind of like, okay, what's this person saying? And, to me, I think there's also, personally speaking, when I've spoke to many people at festivals and stuff, there seems to be like this attitude of, oh, you can't do that, you can't do that. And it's like, well, look, there's no written rules. All you're kind of really being self sorry the only reason you're self-censoring yourself is that you think societal norms are this way, so I can't do this, I've got to fall in line. And the problem with that is the independent should be the anti-Hollywood. Like, the independent should be the punk rock, where Hollywood's making like overproduced pop music. We should be like kind of thinking, you know what, this is what we're gonna do. Because independence, 70s movies, 70s and 80s movies, exploitation, Hollywood's copied them. Like the sex movies, Hollywood copied them. And it's like, it's always the independents that are kind of like the torchbearers, and they're kind of like the ones that are pushing forward, pushing the envelope, as it were. And then Hollywood comes along and does the same thing. So why do what Hollywood do when you can just do the opposite and stand out and have a good chance of standing out? Like you said, Host was very refreshing. It was entertaining. And to me, restrictions help creativity. If you're given, like, if I watch a movie at the cinema, I mean, I'm not big on comic book movies, I'm not big on big epic movies with massive budgets. I'm not. But when I
I've
watch
just
a
got a
film,
fatigue. I used to love them, but now I'm
yeah.
like, come on, do something else.
I agree, man. But also, like, you look at it and it's like, well, of course it looks good. They had all this fucking money at their disposal. But like, when you're restricted, you gotta think outside the box, especially on an independent movie, you can come up with more interesting things. You don't have money to burn. You've got to be very kind of, and to me, there's more craft that goes into that than a studio. This is why I feel studio films are more product and independent films are more film art,
And I think that it's obviously harder to see the independent things. I mean, if you go to a lot of festivals, you're going to watch them. But one of the things that I really like about Tubi here is they kind of take anything, and then they have like studio movies in there as well. And I love that they've like, I mean, I don't know how much you've seen because obviously it's not in the UK anymore, but like there's like a weird thing that's got like a rabbit, and that's perfect because it is like going into a rabbit hole. Just like, what's it going to suggest to me? Is it going to be some random thing that two kids in Moldova made with a camcorder? Or is it going to be like a 20th Century Fox movie? You just don't know. And it's like you can watch like all kinds of crap on there, including my film. But
Well,
it's
yeah.
kind of it's yeah, it's fun.
It's amazing. I was in LA the other month and I stayed with Trent Hager, who Trent Hager used to work at Troma. He wrote Citizen Toxie and like recently he wrote like Cheap Thrills, Dead Girl, 6 8 Kill. He's a really cool guy. And he had Tubi and he was showing me Tubi and it has everything. He showed me a movie called Beyond the Seventh Door, I think, and it's like this wild independent film from years ago. And it just so fucking trippy. And yeah, man, Tubi's the best. And you don't mind when the commercials come on in between because you're like, this is just great that there's a platform that has everything. It really kind of shakes it up,
And I think going back to what you were saying about paying for the same product, there's, I know every independent filmmaker gets this. So you make a movie and then you say, oh, like buy my DVD, but then all your mates want to watch it for free. And because you're your mates, you kind of want to let them. But it's weird. But then beyond that, there's not really an audience because the people who know you are kind of the main audience for your stuff. And then it's word of mouth. So I suppose it's kind of like what's the answer? Like, yes, you can watch it for free, but shout about it to your friends. I mean, like, what do you
It's weird, man, because to me it's like you've really got to unfortunately like so when I made Banjo, I was all about the film. I was all about the film, and then when I got shafted on Banjo, I'm like, oh, it's called the film business. So I've had to learn the business side, even though I didn't get into it for the business. Because if I did, I'd one, I'd make a different films, or two, I wouldn't make films. Because really, there's it's not a get rich quick thing. But if you've got if you've got a passion to tell a story, like all filmmaker friends I know always want to tell stories, it's like an addiction in a way. There's nothing better. It's like it's kind of sadomasochistic in a way because you can have the worst time, but everything is worth it at the end. But yeah, so for example, with Banjo, that got leaked on the internet in 2016. The censored version got put out in America. Like the film was already kind of. The bloom was off the rose very quickly with Banjo. So it took me a long time to put together a package that I was, I recut the director's cut, I put the festival cut on there, I put on the short film, I put on the proof of concept trailer, I put on everything. Because I grew up in the age of like, I'm sure obviously you did as well, DVDs and Blu-ray, well, DVDs mainly, where they used to have bonus features
I
and
know, and I
they were
hate that
so
they
cool.
don't.
Yeah,
I, yeah.
it sucks, man. And to be honest with you, man, like the mainstream now that they mainstream now just subscribe to streaming channels and spend a shitload of money, and that's their content. But the cool, outsider indie underground films, the films that play a festival, you can only get on physical media. So to me, it's like the physical media as a medium now is just really for the film fan. It's really for the genre fan because now you've got all these boutique labels like Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Arrow Video, H8 Films. The list goes on, and they're putting out a high quality disc at a high price, and people are willing to pay that because they want to support independent labels, but they also want to own and watch weird films they can't see anymore. I mean, for me, I mean, this sound may sound old fashioned, but. I think indie films should stay away from anything digital. And what I mean by that is this, is the second anything gets on VOD, it's uploaded to the internet free of charge,
It's
right?
on the Pirate Bay that
In a
instant.
second, in a second. In a second, dude. So to me, oh shit.
Even
Gosh,
DVDs,
Blu-ray.
it's a piece of piss to rip a DVD and upload it. I know people can rip Blu-rays too, but that's like there's more things in the way to stop them do that.
Completely. And look, man, like, I'm not against piracy at all whatsoever. I'm really not. But I think when you're an independent filmmaker starting out and you need to kind of recoup your budget back or not, be able to make another movie, set up a big cartel, do pre-orders, promote it, like, speak to, there's so much I think you can do and build up anticipation, like drop trailers and
Yeah.
everything. And like, to me, that's, and obviously the festival run, that's another thing. So what I did on Eating Miss Campbell, which I thought was a pretty good idea, when it world premiered last August in London, I printed off like 300 flyers and it said on it, "Thank you for coming to the world premiere of Eating Miss Campbell. If you like the movie, you can now pre-order this Blu-ray for the next 72 hours." That weekend, I made like 3 grand just
Oh,
because I
that's
had the.
clever. I am totally going to
Yeah.
steal that and I'll be in touch
It's.
to like, so how do you, where do you make the
Yeah.
cards? How do you do this? Yeah.
Yeah. I think you just got to be smart about it, dude, really.
Because.
I obviously, to me, it's like you've got, as an independent filmmaker, you want to make money so you can continue doing this.
Yeah.
And that's the, and that's it. It's
And
not
so
a
you
get
can
rich.
stop working night shifts. I mean, that's really, you want to make make money making films
Exactly.
so you can make money making films.
Yeah, or distributing films, because I find, like, to me, I think I'm going to go more into the distribution side of things, because you can monetize a tangible item immediately. Making a movie, especially if you're funding it yourself, it can, I mean, like, Eating Miss Campbell costs 60 grand. It costs a lot of fucking
Man.
money. And I'm just like, yo,
So
what?
I got questions about all the money stuff still because that's where I'm really bad. Like this is like so the film I'm making now is the first time I've ever had any money. And it's this weird position, and it's nothing like that. It's this weird position of like, okay, like you're saying, I kind of feel it's weird to pay some people and not others. I'm still gonna make the movie for basically free. Like I'm gonna do everything myself. The last movie I like designed all the artwork and made the physical Blu-ray and all the menu structure and stuff, but the software I have annoyingly doesn't have a facility for separate audio tracks because we're talking about special features. Like my absolute favorite feature on DVDs and Blu-rays is the commentary because
Without a
you
doubt.
just learn so much. And like I wanted to do one, but the only way I could like budget would be to have like another video file and then I'm eating up space on the disc and it's But yeah, if you can help me put a package together, I've got tons of stuff I'd want to do because I think you're right. Like that's the film school, and even like big budget movies, occasionally you get really quirky extra features, and they stick with you. I remember on Once Upon a Time in Mexico, Rodriguez does like a cooking class. It's like what?
Yeah, man, no, dude.
But anyway.
Yeah, no, without doubt, man. Like, there's, I to me, the number one thing a Blu-ray needs to have is an audio commentary. If it does, like, I'll sacrifice the making of documentary. I'll sacrifice deleted scenes. Give me an audio commentary. I really want to know what the fuck was going in or going on in this person's mind. And there's some really good entertaining ones out there. I mean, growing up, I learned so much by just listening to DVD audio commentaries. It really kind of opens your ears up, should I say, to a lot of things. But yeah, man, like, with the whole, like you say, money thing, to me, I don't know, it's easier in the UK, I think, because in the UK, like, everyone, I mean, especially from Yorkshire, there's really no film industry whatsoever. It's all in London. So anyone
No,
that
there's
is
the, I'm
interested in,
sure there's the showroom shorts in Sheffield, and that's about it.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, ex completely. Yeah, that is true. That is true. There is. But at the same time, it's all, they're all non-union. They're all independent. So if you want to get people on board to make a movie, they're more willing to, where, in London, LA, New York, a lot of people want, because there is standard non-union rates and it's very fucking expensive. Where over in the UK, you can negotiate that. And plus, in the UK, with locations, especially exteriors and stuff, sometimes you don't even, I mean, I never really ask for permission, especially exteriors, because, how many times does a film shoot in like Doncaster or Sheffield? Very rarely. I mean, if anything,
Whenever
people see a,
whenever it's you or me, basically.
yeah, exactly, that's it, exactly, that's the only two
Yeah.
time. And even then people are thinking, oh, what's this, they're making the Blair Witch Project, or the making a porn. It's
Every
one of
single
those two.
time. It's like I nearly called this podcast "So You're Making a Porn," because every time you tell someone you're a filmmaker, it's like you make a porno. Every
Oh,
time.
every time, man. Every time. It's like a porno or the Blair Witch Project. It's like,
Yeah.
yeah, because to a lot of people, they don't understand that there's this like independent like film scene. They just think like the films that get made are the ones on Netflix and at the cinema. That's it. You know, and if they hear
Yeah.
that you're making a film, they have this weird idea of what that is. And and I get it. I get it. You can't expect everyone to understand.
So how much, I mean, like, how much did you manage to get back on Banjo? Like, how much did it end up costing you in the end? Like, what, how did that work out financially?
So 15 grand was for the film, kind of all in originally in 2014, 2015, and then putting it on Blu-ray and everything. I probably added an extra 10 grand in post-production, and then like Blu-ray replication was like maybe 5 grand. So it's like an extra 15 grand. So it's like,
So
yeah,
you spent 30 grand on the movie.
yeah.
Did it make anything back? Or have you got like a
I
massive
mean,
debt now?
no, man. I mean, like I've made quite a lot on the Blu-rays. I mean, I've sold just over 500 Blu-rays for Banjo at £25 each.
Nice, nice.
So it's made a
Yeah.
pretty, you know, it's getting there, and it's only been on sale for like 5 6 weeks now. And
For
this is what
sure.
I mean. I think it's always best to self-distribute because, you know, if I give Banjo to another distributor over here, then I won't see a penny, you know, and like the
And
kind of
it'll be
advances.
crap. Like I've seen, like your
Yeah.
things are amazing. You know, they're like personalized artwork. And the other thing with doing it yourself is you can sign everything, which like adds value.
Completely. Well, I mean, in my case, it devalues the
Who's, well, this isn't new. Someone's written on there.
Yeah. Seriously, it's like, you know, I think an unsigned banjo would go for more money than a signed banjo, but you know.
Nice. That's
Yeah,
cute.
but yeah, but no, dude, seriously, I do think like filmmakers, self-distribution is probably the way to go. And because now the market is much cheaper to get stuff replicated because they don't have that demand anymore. You know,
Yeah.
it's like, you know what, man, it'll come round again. People will want to own things like vinyl records. If you told me 20 years ago when CDs and MP3s were the rage, oh, people are going to go back to buying vinyl records, I'd be like, shut the fuck up, you know?
True. Or like you, because I guess it's because of like Stranger Things and there's like weird 80s fetish. Like I've seen people with Walkmans. Like there is no reason at all to use a cassette walk other than because it looks cool. Because it sounds worse than the MP3s on your phone and it's massive. But
It,
it's
yeah.
still, it's like a quirky thing to have.
Yeah, you know, and look, I get it. I mean, I think they thought the whole 80s nostalgia thing's been rinsed to death. I mean, like,
Yeah.
in fact, I mean, we're on to the 90s now, I think. I think that's the kind of thing we're going through now. But
Well,
yeah,
they
that'll
already
be
are.
set.
Like, do you see
Yeah.
the advert for the Switch Online thing? It's got a bunch of like people our age playing GoldenEye, and I'm like, shit, I'm old. I do want to go and play GoldenEye.
God, no, I haven't, but I mean that'll probably give me PTSD. It's like, oh fuck. You know, yeah, I think, you know, like being our age though, like I remember when I was younger, if I thought someone was like 37, 38, I'd be like, wow, that's really old.
Yeah.
But now it's kind of like I feel like this, like 37 is like the new 27, maybe.
I don't know. I mean, I still feel like a 20-year-old's gonna think I'm old, but I think what's interesting about pushing 40, I'm trying to like get myself used to this, is it's just because it is a middle point. I mean, I guess it's middle age. Like it is a good point where if someone's 60, I can relate to them. And if someone's 20, I can relate to them. Because you kind of have this like weird experience where you can kind of see a lot of people's different viewpoints, which I think really helps with writing. You know, because you can imagine yourself in like other people's like worlds in a way that you maybe can't when you're 20 because you just don't know because everyone's old.
I agree, yeah. And I mean, if you look at a lot of the big directors, they didn't start really their big movies until they were like 40. So, I mean, Lloyd Kaufman directed The Toxic Avenger when he was like 40 years old. So, you know.
My odd relationship with trauma, I think I've seen like two of them, like as in, like I'm not trauma fan. I remember I've definitely seen Romeo and Juliet because that kind of bizarrely traumatized me when I was a teenager. Like this thing where she's like eating popcorn and it's like weird.
Yeah, there's the penis monster in the dream sequence, and then
Bothered me less, but now you point out, I'm like, oh yeah.
I
But and I remember watching that Toxic Avengers cartoon when I was a kid. I used to, I had all the figures and everything. Just
same,
weird
yeah, man. It
stuff.
came out,
Yeah.
yeah, it's so weird. I mean, it came out around the same time as like Captain Planet and stuff, and
Yeah.
Bucky O'Hare, yeah.
Probably still got them somewhere on one side.
But yeah, like Toxic Avenger, man. I remember seeing that when I was 11 years old for the first time and just thinking, wow, this is really fucked up. The first movie where they run over a kid's head with a car really messed me up at 11 years
But
old.
it goes back to what we were saying before, because that's weird, because they're in a sort of indie studio place. You know what I mean? It's kind of like it's independent, but it's not me and our mates with a camera. It's like, there's a budget, but it's not like we're getting in the cinema. It's we're aiming for TV and cable and DVD and the rest of it.
Totally, man. No, without a doubt. I mean, like, Troma is the longest running independent film studio in the world. I mean, they'll be reaching 50 years next year. And Troma also own their own, they own all their own negatives. They own all their own films, where a lot of independent, filmmakers or companies, they license them out to different distributors and studios. So, Troma is, like I say, they've done a lot in the past 50 years, and I think they've done a lot to help other filmmakers. But yeah, it's really weird because I find like a lot of film festivals are snobbish when it comes to trauma. Like they look down on trauma. Even a few ones in the UK very much, but at the same time it's kind of like like at least trauma is doing something different. At least like there's the intelligence to trauma movies, because it deals trauma movies deal with a lot of social satire. But if you want to just take what's on the surface of nudity, on the surface, sorry, of nudity, ultra violence, and slapstick comedy, but don't understand what it's trying to convey, then I think you're missing the point of a trauma movie. I think you're really missing the whole message.
But I think in a way it's sort of like a spiritual successor to the Hammer movies because they were like very much a thing.
Yeah, with that, it's an in-house studio that has an ethic, has themes, that people don't say, hey, I've seen this, I don't know, horror comedy. They say, oh, I've seen this trauma film. And I think when you say the word trauma, you expect certain things when you watch the films.
So, post banjo, what do you do? What happens next? Let's get back to actually talking about
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, so post Banjo. So Banjo came out, played festivals for a year. Then got leaked on the internet in 2016 and unceremoniously got released on DVD. So that would then follow maybe 3 or 4 years. No, 3 years of depression, 3 years of being suicidal, and 3 years of not like, it was terrible. It was awful. It's still, it's what I deal with today, but like with the search relief, everything is so much better. But yeah, man, like seriously, I was lost. I was like, up, it was a real blow to my confidence, my self-esteem, and everything. It's like, oh shit, I guess I wasn't meant to make films or whatever. But
You mean because it
yeah,
didn't find a big audience or what? Like
not
what?
so much that, but like how it was tracked by the distributor. It got leaked online and it got censored, and it wasn't the release it should have been, and it got they owned the rights for 10 years. I just felt like, why would I go through all that again? Why would I go through, because as making films is it's hard work. Why would I go through that trauma again? But I still had stories to tell, and Ian Miss Campbell became, I guess my feelings towards I don't know, politics and life and everything for a good like 4 or 5 years after Banjo. So yeah, man, like I had a lot of time to think of things, and out came Ian Miss Campbell, and we started shooting in January 2020. And then we had to shut down production. Well, not we so we shot the first installment in January 2020, then COVID happened, and then that shut down. Well, that prevented us from doing anything until September 2021, where we had to finish the movie, and then I started playing festivals a year later.
And there's faces in that I recognize as well. Like there's a lot of kind of like Leeds, like Yorkshire, like actor people who like
That's
maybe
right.
some of them I met, some of them I haven't, but like they're people who I've seen in other indie things and I'm like, oh, I know, you know, like famous to me, but not famous.
No, I get it. Yeah, no, totally, man. Like, and it's a sequel to Banjo. It originally wasn't a sequel to Banjo. I
I
only
need to
wrote it
watch
as a
Banjo
sequel.
so I can understand.
Well, this is why I tell people just so that I can buy the Blu-ray. No, but
Right.
seriously, it is. I mean, you can watch it
You
using a
can hand deliver
smartphone.
that. You could take it to my mum's house in Rosington and be
There
like
we go. Yeah,
that.
that is a personal touch, but yeah, man, like the idea for me to make it like a quasi sequel to Banjo was, well, I can market Banjo as well as eating Miss Campbell, so then I've got like two films that are kind of connected. But I've always loved movies like trauma movies do it, Kevin Smith films do it. It's I like reoccurring characters and stuff. So yeah, so Ian S. Campbell produced by Lloyd Kaufman. Trauma owned the US rights, and then I negotiated to own all the other territory rights.
Oh, nice. Smart.
You learn these things. You learn these things once you. To me, I think it's good to fail. It's good to fail early, so you can start learning things. And but then again,
So,
I'm
did
still failing.
you negotiate this with Lloyd then? Like, to get them, I don't know, are they like, presumably they're financially invested in making the movie as well? Like, is that ahead of the.
So like so Lloyd came to me wanting to distribute it in Miss Campbell, well, wanting to produce it in Miss Campbell. This was before we shot it, and I sent him the script. He loved the script, and Michael, his business partner, Michael Herz, he offered me an amount for worldwide rights, and I was like, for this I'd rather you just have American rights because you've got distribution in America. If you're going to distribute it around the world, you'd license it to different companies. So I'd rather Trauma distribute it in the US and then I license with these different companies. So then the money's going to me, the filmmaker.
Smart.
And, I think you have to, and I love Trauma, and Trauma is like the perfect home for Miss Campbell. And they've done so much with it theatrically. I mean, it had sold out screenings in New Jersey, sold out screenings in New York. It had three sold out screenings in LA and Glendale. A couple of months ago now. It's going to play the Mahoning Drive-In in July this year, where it's going to be cool. And it played Las Vegas. Trauma done so much with the film, and it's fantastic. It's a dream for me, being like a lifelong Trauma fan since I was 11 years old, to be a part of the Trauma team in some ways.
And it is interesting how, because I mean, I can see that. Like, I can see how it's a trauma film. I mean, like I said, I've not seen many, but I get what they're about. But then some of the like humor is like very British, you know? It's kind of like it's a nice thing that you've done to like tie it together, like the sort of the sarcasm and the like knowing kind of, you know, like what is the thing with like the 30-year-old teenagers or whatever, like.
Yeah,
Just like
well,
little
I
bits like
yeah, I mean, to
it's
me.
great.
Yeah, to me, you've got to be self-aware, because if not, critics are going to fucking shit all over you. So it's like kind of like the fat kid in school making fun of himself. It's like, yeah, 30-year-old playing high school students, it's because that is a
Yeah.
trope in American movies, it's Saved by the
Absolutely.
Bell, like, so why not, satire that. But yeah, man, like, where am I going with this? So Trauma, Ian Miscavige. Oh, sorry, British humor. Sorry, yes. I grew up watching Bottom is my favorite British sitcom, and I'm a huge, Rick Mayall fan and Aid Edmondson fan. So a lot of the slapstick violence in EMC, and some of the humor is certainly like being influenced by like Young Ones and Bottom and Red Dwarf, and like just a multitude of British sitcoms that came out in the 90s,
And it's funny because I told you I'm making something tonally similar now because I made this last film and like showed it to a couple of distribution people and we're like, oh, it's kind of a little bit out here, see, I don't know. It's not really, it's just cheap. But it's not a horror movie and it's not VelociPasta, do you know what I mean? So it's kind of it's not got like a hook to like make people go, oh, I'm gonna watch this even if it's shit. It's good, but it's like a play, really. It's like a little quiet like movie between two people, and they're like, make a horror movie. So I tried to write a horror movie and realized quickly that I can't write a straight horror movie. It's kind of
No.
like self-aware horror musical satire thing. But that's what I'm making now. It's like it is that, but it's like genre horror movie, but it kind of knows that it is. Kind of like, I don't know, because it's not like Scream, it's not like Scary Movie, but it's somewhere in that sort of space. You know, it's like
I
it's a
get it.
horror
It's like
movie,
a,
but it's a
it's a self-aware chamber piece that you're wanting to make, like in like one location, probably on stage or something.
no, I mean, like, this is the new one. So like the new one
Oh.
is it's ridiculous. Like the first one was just a straight drama, really. And then this one is it's trying to be bigger, and I've shot myself in the foot because I got loads of actors and locations or whatever. But what I was gonna say is the opening monologue to your movie, I'm like, ah, oh, shit. Because it's essentially
Oh.
like tonally what you're doing, because it is hilarious. You know how like you come on and like you just play with the expectations, and like this like the first couple of minutes of your film, I was like, oh my God, this is great. It's like
Well,
rolling.
it's weird, man, because like I've realized that people either really like Ian Miscampbell or they really fucking hate Miscampbell. Like, you know, I've listened to some scouring podcast reviews where I wouldn't even call them a review, I'd call it just a complete like 5 minute rape.
Right, and
Yeah,
it's got
like,
a 4.6 on IMDb, and I'm looking at that. I'm like, who are these assholes doing this? And this happens to a
well,
lot of like no budget movies. I feel like there's people who go on just to drag everyone down.
yeah, there's one guy called Fraser Brown who's a complete dickhead.
Do you want me to cut this, or are you fine with potential libel?
There's no libel. He is a dickhead, you know?
Okay, fine.
So the guy fucking once started the movie the morning after the world premiere. So I, the morning after
No.
the morning after the greatest night of my life, it certainly was. It really kind of bummed me out. And at that time, it came down to like 2.1 or something because he made so many fucking fabricated accounts. But you know,
Oh, so it's
that
not like
guy.
leaving one review, it's some knobhead making a bunch of accounts to drag your movie down.
What happened? So now the
Why?
algorithm's fucked. Because he's a prick. I mean, look, he's, you know, he did a Kickstarter called Tales from the Quarantine where he says it's for charity. He made 38 grand. He's not shipped any books out. I mean, you know, just Google him. You know, unfortunately, I met him through trauma and he's a complete dickhead.
So what you're saying is, if ever I meet this person, what's his name, Fraser?
Fraser Brown. Fraser Brown.
Fraser Brown. So avoid Fraser Brown because he will shit over my movies, is what I'm getting.
Well, yeah, completely. Yeah, especially if you've, you know, yeah, completely. He's just a prick, you know. And the only reason why he did it because it's because I called him out on his bullshit. Because as you know, there's so many bullshitters in the indie film scene that try to make out that they're something they're not for some kind of fucking swagger, and then you realize that they're bringing down other people's films, creating multiple Twitter accounts, and you're like, you're such a toxic person that you're fucking doing this. You're a piece of shit. I'm calling you out. Because I called him out, I'm like persona non grata now. But you know, all you need to do is like Google his name or put it in Twitter and you'll see. So I mean,
No.
you know, I don't think calling him a dickhead libel because I'm sure if anyone else if because it's fucking
I
true,
can
you know.
imagine this in court now. It's like, but mate, you are a dickhead, and like everyone's like, no, he's a dick.
Isn't you know what, man? It's no different to what I've said about him on Twitter. So there we go.
Fair enough. Well, there we go. It's all
And
out
not just
there.
me, and not just me, hundreds of people, because he scammed at least 400 people, 38 grand to go to charity. And then you fucking don't send it to charity, you ignore people, and you gaslight them for like a year. He brought all these really famous comic book artists on board to create a graphic novel called Tales from the Quarantine. Obviously, it was around the COVID time. And then all the fucking, everyone got shafted, and he ran off with 38 grand because he's a piece of shit. But anyway.
It's just
Sorry, I can't, that was kind of like a
no.
digression. I have to cut
It's
that bit
good
out.
to be
Yeah.
aware of these things, and like my
Yeah, there's
brain's
so
in
many.
like, okay, let's turn this into a movie.
Hey, why not? You know, why not? Yeah, there's so many not good people in the industry as well. But there's a, you know, I think the indie film scene, and I hate saying industry because I'm not in the industry. That's another thing. I'm not in the industry. I'm just an independent filmmaker that gets to make a movie every now and then. I'm not in the industry, but there's so many people that the film scene, should we call it, the film scene attracts the best of people, and it also attracts the worst of people. You know? But that's like anything, I guess.
Yeah.
I also feel like I've got a good bullshit detector as well, though. You know, so that helps. Have a bullshit detector. It really helps.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a little bit too wary of people, to be honest. Like, or I feel like I don't really like asking people for help because then it's kind of like, well, if like, this person helps me, then I owe them. Or, like, you know, it's kind of a nice.
I mean, sometimes, I mean, yeah, I get that, but at the same time, I love helping people. I love giving advice. I love telling people
Oh,
the
same,
things
same.
I've,
I'm fine to put myself out there, but I just find it hard to accept help.
yeah, no, I get that. I get
Like,
that, you know, and but there are people out there that will. So, I mean, there is certain people that won't, and they want to keep all the cards to the chest. But to me, it's like, if one of us win, we all win together. You
Yeah.
know, it's seriously, a film is not made by one person. It's a collaboration of people.
True.
It really is.
And
And
I am
to me,
amazed. Sorry, I interrupted you. I was just gonna say I'm
no, it's
amazed by
cool. No,
people
it's
who
fine.
are willing to help. Like people who the stuff that I would have assumed I've had to pay for here, that everyone's like, no, it's fine, you know. So like locations that I've been able to use for free, like businesses and stuff, and like people are just like, no, it's fine. I'm like, do you want me to like promote you in the credits or something? And that's kind of 50-50. Like half I'm like, no, it's fine. I like you. Who you think? I'm like,
Yeah,
Like,
man. It's not,
yeah.
it do it, it put it puts faith in the human race. You know,
Yeah,
at
exactly.
times when you feel like, yeah, it really does. There's some lovely people out there, and to me, it's all about just being down to earth, being yourself, being a narcissistic dickhead, and that usually helps. You know, just being a nice person. You know, whoop-de-doo. You know, but it's true. It's true. It really is. And like, I feel like I try to be so down to earth with things, and I also explain to people, hey, I have a technical support job I have to go back to. So if I can do this, you can do this. Because at the end of the
Yeah.
day, it's like when I used to go to film festivals, and I used to, like my first film festival I ever went to on my own because no one else wanted to come with me was Fright Fest in 2010. And I sat there in the audience and I saw these filmmakers, you know, from England and flown all around the world. And I'm like, these guys are living the dream. Oh my God, I'd love to be one of these people one day. But in the reality of things, like actors and everything, they have real day jobs, they have real
Yeah.
jobs that they do. And because they're not always working, you know, it's so to me, it's always good to break that illusion sometimes to be like, to be of this stature to make a movie. It's like, look, if I can make one, anyone can make one. And to me, that's so inspiring. I mean, look, we've got the tools now with digital filmmaking over the past 10 years or 15 years. It's given everyone the tool to make a movie. The only issue now is it's hard to stand out because it's all oversaturated, which is a good thing and bad
Right.
thing. But it's like anything else, you know, there's what is good and bad as well. It's like that's such a subjective opinion. And to me, you know, if someone creates something and it, you know, it doesn't have to be the best thing, but if it shows like they took the time and the care and the love, that shines through. The passion shines through anything. And you can tell when you watch a movie for multi-millions of pounds when there's no passion and it's just fucking to tick loads of boxes. And, you know, so a budget does not define if it's a good film or a bad film. To me, it's
Agreed.
all about the execution of the director.
And I think probably because I've made like so many little shorts and the one feature with no money, like I'm personally a lot more forgiving of like technical fluffs or like things that don't quite work. You know, when I watch a film, even if I think it's shit, I can always think, oh, but I did like this one bit, like studio or independent. Like there's usually something in there where you can either see passion or you can see like something that was like a good idea. So I think most things, even if they're not like the most enjoyable thing you ever watch, they're kind of interesting from a study point of view to like take things
Oh,
from or, you know, learn
without a
from.
doubt, man, you can learn so much from a film you don't enjoy. You can learn more from a film you don't enjoy than the movie you do enjoy. But also, even though if I don't enjoy a certain film, if I hear that someone else loved it, that's amazing because films at
Yeah.
the end of the day were designed to find their own audience and to entertain people,
And
you
it,
know,
so what you were
and
saying is what's good and bad.
yeah.
It's just it's different. Everyone brings their own life experiences to whatever they're watching. So it, you know.
Oh, without doubt, the films I make aren't for everybody whatsoever. I mean, they're quite niche of a niche. But at the same time, I go into writing movies thinking, what do I want to see? What story do I want to tell? What can I put into the script? What, how can I make this different? And some, you know, and then, oh, there's no nicer feeling that this little seed, this little idea that's come from your head is now on the big screen, and people are laughing along and people are enjoying themselves. To me, that there's no greater feeling in the world.
No, I agree. And it's just nice to, like, I know a lot of actors, obviously, and I like how films are permanent. You know, you can do plays and things and it's great while you're doing it, but then it's gone. But like films, you know, I've got like stupid little things I made on a VHS-C camcorder when I was 16 that I can watch now. And I just like that it's kind of like it's there forever and you can always find a way to have it be forever. And it's like when you watch films from the 30s now and you're like, everyone involved with making this is dead. But the piece still exists. And I love that about it. And I don't like to be like, oh, it's an art form. But like, no, it is. It's
It's a way to leave something behind, you know.
yeah.
It's a way to like say, "Hey, I was here." In some ways, it's a way to kind of like, not, I don't want to sound like to be immortal, but like, you know what I mean? It's like saying, "Hey, I did something," right? Like for me, you know, the whole like marriage and kids thing just didn't, you know, just didn't work out, didn't appeal, and I found love with my first love, which was film. And I decided to stick with it because to me, I find that for me at least, it's fulfilling, and for me, it's what drives me, you know.
And I think that's a barrier for a lot of people in whatever their career is. Maybe half of all people, especially kids, like have kids, and then it's like, okay, well, my life is kids now. And then
Yeah,
they
no, of
just
course.
kind of they'll still do their day job, but all their kind of passion projects fall apart. Whereas I think for me it's the same sort of thing. It's like, you know, we're at that age, it's like, I'm never gonna have kids. I'm like, well, I'm still a kid, you know. Like, not that I couldn't take care
Yeah,
of a kid. I
same.
absolutely could. But if I take care of a kid, I think I'd be a decent parent. But that's my life project. Whereas I do feel like, you know what? I haven't done the films I want to do. Like that, these are the things that, like, you know, if I'm on my deathbed, I would probably, this is horrible if I have kids and they listen to this now. But like, if I'm on my deathbed, I'm like, but I didn't make that one film I wanted to make. That will disappoint me more than, oh, I never had kids.
Without doubt, dude, I completely
Yeah.
agree. You know, and maybe it's our generation. Maybe it is. Maybe because, you know, we were there with the infancy of the internet, you know, but we also knew what life was before the internet. And I also feel like with society, there was like this kind of design for life in a way, design of you know, you go to college, you go to school, you go to college, you get married, or you go into full-time work, you meet someone, you get married, you procreate. You're a parent, then you die. And I
Right.
think like with the internet now, it feels like the whole world's opened up to everybody. You know, I'm talking about the late 90s, early 2000s now. And I feel like, you know, when you see other people doing things that, because, you know, like without the internet and stuff and without the access to a lot of things, I don't think I'd think, oh wow, I can be a filmmaker. Because I remember
Absolutely
being in
not.
the
You're right.
no, I remember being in school, my final year in school, and they have like these people that come in like career advisors, and like, you know, they said, "So what do you want to be?" And I said, "You know, I want to be a filmmaker." And then she said to me, "Well, there's not many filmmakers that come out of South Yorkshire, do you know?" And then she's like, "What did your dad do?" And I'm like, "Drive buses." It's like, well, maybe that's something you can go
I think we had the
into.
same career advisor. We probably did. Yeah, it's probably one person who went to school. So I said to her, like, I'm interested in filmmaking. And we looked at a couple of jobs, and she's like, well, you're gonna have to, you probably want to get a more sensible career, you know, or you'll have to move to London, but that's expensive, isn't it? Don't you want maybe wanna? What are your parents doing? Like, well, unemployed. It's like, yeah, it's not gonna happen for you.
It's scary, isn't it? Like how many people may have like wanted to be something or wanted to follow a passion, and it was crushed in that moment because, you know, some people, they do listen to authority, well, you know, authority, or, you know, people like teachers, and, you know, and I respect all that. I do respect all that, but I also understood at a young age that that's their opinion. That doesn't mean that opinion is right, you know.
Yeah,
And sometimes it's, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think something else you said, and I've spoken about this in the podcast, I think, but I've definitely spoken about it with people, is we're so lucky to have had both worlds. Like, I feel sorry for kids now who've always been connected to the internet and always known it, but it's nice to kind of know how things, I was going to say, know how things used to work. Things like writing checks, they still do that in America, it's weird. Yeah, and just, you know, like going to a place, or like if you want to see your friends, you have to go and knock on their door and ask if they're coming out and that kind of thing. And it's nice to have had that, like, I suppose, like global childhood be my childhood. And like now that everything's exposed, you know, and if some girl from the middle of nowhere in Romania wants to be an international model, she can. She just has to start an Instagram account. Or if we want to be filmmakers, we have to like reach out to the right people using the internet. I mean, you were saying about with Lloyd Kaufman through the internet, like emailing him. It's not like you were gonna fly to America and go and knock on his door like a stalker, but because the internet was available to you. I mean, even writing letters, you just, where would you even get their address without the internet?
Right, exactly.
Like,
It's the internet's opened up so much, and I think this is why, and also with international travel being as cheap as ever,
might
compared
be for
to
Europeans, mate. It's not.
oh no, I've heard for like when you're in America, just to fucking travel to another state is like probably double or triple than what it would cost me to fly from Manchester to New
It's
York. It's
it
crazy.
is mental. Flights from Buffalo to New York average about $150. Now, that's, yeah, it's a 6-hour drive, whatever. But $150 is 3 weekends away with accommodation included on EasyJet. And that's when people say, what do you miss about England? What I miss is living in Europe, where you can go wherever you want, quick, cheap.
Exactly, completely, without a doubt, man, without a doubt. I mean, I love America. I love visiting America. I don't know if I could move there.
I think, honestly, I think, I mean, you've probably spent enough time there to know this, but I think it's a good place to spend a decent amount of time, because I feel like because America is so dominant in the world, but especially in popular culture, it's useful to live here to kind of know how things really are in America, and like the ins and outs of like daily life, as well as what you see on TV and how what's movies versus what's reality. And I've only got one city to base this on, so I'm sure other cities are different. I'm not in any way claiming that living in Boston's the same as living in Buffalo or whatever, but probably, you know, this cultural identity as well. Like, I'm not the weird one in England, although I do like being the weird one because it's a good conversation starter.
Yeah, completely, without a doubt, man. You know, if anything, being weird is like a superpower in a way, because
Yeah.
I remember, like, I'm sure you were as well. I was bullied in school for being different, and then like you realize that no, that was like a good thing. You know,
Definitely.
that was a good thing, and it shows. I'm not saying bullying is a good thing. I'm not saying bullying builds character, but it kind of does. You know, it's like
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of messed up, but it also because I always feel like I'm more of an independent thinker in a way than a lot of people. You know, not in a conspiracy theory sense or anything, but like more of a this my way, or I'll like for example, I have a call center job, but I'm also making films on the side. Some people
Right.
don't have that. Some people can just go home, they've got a family, they've got kids, and that makes them happy. I'm a little jealous of that because I'm like, well, I am happy when I make films, but I'm always wanting more. I'm always wanting to push myself. I'm never comfortable. But also, I don't know what the alternative to that would be because this is the only drive I have to do anything. So it's nice to have something that keeps me on my toes. With filmmaking, as you know, there's always something to do. Well, okay, now I've got to write the script. Oh, now I've got to do this redraft. Now I've got to plan this. Now I've got, there's always something to do, which is a great blessing in a way, you know. And to me, it's like what life is like watching a great movie. You just don't want it to end. And I feel that
Right.
with projects. Like, okay, one project is done, and there's this somber kind of funeral feel. I think, especially at festivals, it's like, oh wow, that was the world premiere, and that's done. And now on to the next chapter. And to me, as long as you've got something else to look forward to, it's all good.
And I don't know if you have this too. It doesn't necessarily feel like, oh, I'm trying to forge a career. It's more, I just want to make a thing. But I find it hard to, not relax, but like, because I have different jobs as well that I do for money that I got nothing to do with the film. But then when I've got a day to myself, I do kind of, I don't know if it's like guilt or just kind of thinking like, well, put a couple of hours into doing something creative. Like, I can't just sit on my ass all weekend and play Tears of the Kingdom. I would love to, but I'd feel guilty. So I was like, but at least part of the time, I'm like, I want to be working on something that's gonna, I want to say further my career, but that makes me sound like one of those like suit people. It's not, it's just that's, it's a different kind of fulfillment. I think if I've like sat and worked on something for one of my projects, right now I'm subtitling, I'm moving into Spanish so I can get it on Amazon Mexico. And it, but it feels like this is a worthwhile use of my time. It's completely unpaid, that maybe might pay off creatively at some point. And it's just like, it's like
Man,
yeah.
I completely agree. I'm the exact same. And dude, there's nothing worse than having to fucking write subtitles for your own movies. Like I had to do it for both Banjo and EMC, and my God, it's such a pain in the ass, right? Because there's just I'm like, next film, I'm gonna write a silent film. There's gonna be no dialogue because that's probably my films. Everyone's fucking talking all the time, and then you've got to fucking write that up. And yeah, it's a
Yeah.
pain in the ass. It took me like a week to do each movie.
Well, now I'm translating it as well, and it's taking a lot longer because it's not just like, oh, translate the movie. Because there's, you know, there's things that are like, you know, they've got a double meaning, and that's why the dialogue works. And then I have to kind of step back and go, okay, am I gonna lo lose this, or am I gonna get wordy explaining it? And it's a translating is a weird, awkward thing. And then when I do that, Amazon might go, no, it's not our content requirements. I haven't when I've spent like however many hours doing this. But it's a fun experiment. It's a way to like revisit
It
and
is. It is, you know, and I've tried to submit stuff to Amazon before, and they'll say, oh, something's not in the right format or whatever. And then I'm like, for me at least, I'm like, is my audience on Amazon? And look, I'm not like, look, to me, I think you should exhaust all the distribution channels as you can. You need to. You really do. And I really believe in that. And to me, it's going to be an experiment because I mean, you know, I will resubmit to Amazon because to me, it's like, you know, will this generate revenue? Will this generate more people watching it? I don't know. Maybe you
It's
can tell
not a
me,
ton of
you
not a
know.
ton of views on Amazon. So it's weird because I found Amazon, I mean they've changed the goalpost now, but I found Amazon for a couple of shorts that I made. So two of my shorts are on Amazon UK and Amazon USA. And they're on the German one too, because a friend of mine like did the subtitles, like translated my subtitles, so I got them the German one too. But a few years ago, they used to accept independent like shorts, and now they only accept independent features. And when I submitted my feature, they rejected it with like very like wishy-washy, not specific. It's like, technically you fulfilled everything, but we're not a fan of the content. It was kind of like, yeah, it's not for us, kind of thematically or whatever. I saved a screenshot of it somewhere. I can say exactly what they said, but it was kind of, and it was like, do not resubmit this, doesn't. But then I used FilmHub. I don't know if you know about FilmHub.
Yeah,
And
it's like an aggregator, right?
right, and now it's on Amazon because FilmHub took the exact same movie, suggested it, and now it's on there.
Because you're doing
But
it through
the
a
problem with it being
yeah.
on FilmHub is, like you were saying, it's like the self-distribution. If you put it on Amazon yourself, you can, you know, you can go on and see how many minutes. It's like YouTube. You can go on and see how many minutes somebody's watched it, where they were when they watched it, and so on. Whereas when it's FilmHub, it's all this like mystique. But what I will say is, the money I've got from Amazon for my movie, I don't know, like probably three people a month buy it. So the amount of work I'm doing on the subtitles, it were absolutely not, because I've probably made like £2 a month from Amazon. Whereas FilmHub, I mean, I'm not in any way minted, and the film costs nothing to make. But like FilmHub's doing better, sorry, Tubi's doing better. And what I like about Tubi is you don't have to say, pay to watch my movie, because it's free. And yeah, just put up with a couple of adverts.
Exactly,
It's
man. Yeah, without
easier to
doubt.
get people to watch something for free as well. But the
It is.
piracy thing, I mean, this is kind of one of those where, oh, I don't like piracy. I've got to protect my artistic merit. But like, someone ripped my film and dubbed the entire thing into Hindi. I'm like, that's so cool.
That is awesome because then now you can sell to yeah, you can sell that now, right? You don't have to get someone to dub it. That's
I
pretty
know,
cool.
like
That happens a lot.
I thought this is like, I should rip the pirated version and upload it to my next DVD, because what are they going to do? Claim copyright on their dub?
Completely. I would totally do that. I would totally do that. You know, sometimes it can be a blessing in disguise. But I also feel like this, you know, the people that pirate movies are different to the people that purchase films or rent films. I think they're completely different audience. And also, they really like it, they'll buy it, you know. And if not, then they were never going to buy it in the first place. I think that's the way to look at it,
I
because
agree.
you
And
can't, yeah,
I
you
bet
can't
you've
fight
double
silly
dipped as
Hulk.
well.
Out a million times, all the time, a million times. I'm
There's
just
films that I own
guilty.
on like VHS, DVD, digital,
Oh,
Blu-ray, because it's
I own Toxic Avenger 10 times over VHS, Laserdisc, DVDs, Blu-rays. You know,
I have 3 Blu-rays of Psycho.
there we go. You know,
Yeah.
I think if you love film, you'll keep rebuying it, especially if there's like new content, new special features, you know.
Yeah. That's a Psycho thing. I had to pay for those extra 2 seconds.
Hey, why not? I mean, yeah, that's what I'll be do that's why I'm doing the Blu-rays. I'm licensing some films, and I'm getting all the available cuts in an inventory, like a studio's inventory, and I'm popping them all on Blu-ray. So I'm kind of like doing like a deep dive, a deep cut, like an archiving of films, which I'll start putting out next year.
That's
So
great.
I'm kind of doing that now, which, you know, is great because I'm a fan of these films as well. And it's nice to be able to contact some of the producers on these films to record new features like audio
Oh,
commentaries
that's
and that.
so exciting. That sounds like an amazing job.
Well, I mean, it's currently an expensive hobby. Hopefully, it'll turn into a job. Like, I'd love to be able to make enough money so I can quit my call center job. But we'll see. We'll see. But like, say, you don't know unless you do it. You really don't. I didn't
Yeah.
expect banjo to sell as well as it did very quickly. And the majority of banjo sales, a lot of it was like wholesale. I've had like six wholesale, like, you know, Diabolik DVD, Orbit DVD, a lot of these like genre Blu-ray sellers contact me and buying films in bulk, which really helps as well, you know. So yeah, man, I mean, there's ways to do it. There's really ways to do it. I mean, I'm getting a website built right now, so it's more of like a professional looking store. That big cartel is just something I threw up because I don't know how to web design. But yeah, we'll see where it goes with the Refuse films. Like, I'm putting out Eat Miss Campbell in September or October. I've licensed 10 independent films from friends that I'm going to eventually put out, and then I've currently signed a contract with a well-known studio to begin distributing those movies as well.
Oh
So we'll see.
wow. So you're going to be a
Yeah.
distributor. That's exciting.
Well, I mean, to me, the idea would be the money I make eventually, I get to make a movie on my own, like every other year, which is, you know, if there's more money incoming than there is at my call center job, then it'll be a lot more easier for me to make films, but also spend my time distributing movies and putting together and like discovering different beta tapes or digibeta tapes and masters of like deleted scenes or whatever. And I think
I'm
that's
like,
where it
okay,
gets
so
my
my
mind
movie's out
on.
on vanilla Blu-ray that I designed everything myself. It's Funaki. Like, I did all the menu structure and everything, but it doesn't have all the features I want. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to send you a bunch of distributables. Like, get my movie on there.
Yeah, man. I mean, like,
Want
look,
the
if you're into it, I'll
commentary.
definitely, you know. Yeah, no, seriously, man. Like, I'll be open to putting out more. It's just, I think January will be the because that's when the first three releases of this other studio these films come out. So that will be the time point. If it's either going to be the start of Refuse films or the end of Refuse films, so we'll see. We'll see.
No, but it's exciting that you're doing it. And then, so beyond that, what can you share about future movie making plans? Like, have you got anything
Yeah,
else?
I'm attached to direct a film, co-direct a film in LA, hopefully in the
Oh,
fall.
sweet.
And
You
this,
get an actual gig rather than like something from your own.
yeah, man. So I'm not funding it, so it's not my money this time. So I mean,
Yeah.
hopefully that goes ahead. I mean, you know, it's a big budget compared to what I'm used to. It's a low budget, but it's definitely like six figures. So that's like a
Oh,
big
sweet.
jump for me. Yeah,
I mean,
so
yours would
hopefully
be a
that,
big, the one you made already would be a big jump for me. I need to start chucking money at things, but like that's
well,
really good getting like a gig. Hopefully it's, I mean, have you read it yet, or do you not know like what's.
man, I'm friendly, like, so I'll be co-directing it with the screenwriter, so I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be great. You know, we've been working on it for quite a, well we've been working on it together for like a couple of months. No, we've been working on it for like 10 months now. But like, it's great. It's a great script. It's funny. It's gory. It's fucked up. So hopefully that happens, because to me, nothing's ever real until you're on set doing it. But
Right.
currently,
To
that
me, nothing's
is
real
in the
until it's
pipe.
finished editing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, because yeah, I agree. Because the anxiety just making it, you think it's just going to fuck up and ruin everything, is it's unbelievable. So I've got that. I've got the distribution, Refuse Films thing putting out Eames Campbell in September, October. What else? I think that's it. I mean, I've got a few ideas for films that I'll eventually make. I'm sure I'll make a Banjo 3 sometime. But for now, all my time and energy and everything else is going into the Refuse Films label, and we'll see if it takes off. And if it does, the upside is great. And if it doesn't, then, I've tried.
And this is the thing, I feel like with a project like that, I mean, you're not gonna be like, even if you completely fell flat on your ass, you're gonna get so much fulfillment from having tried. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, even just doing it feels great.
It does, yeah, it does. It's also a lot of like investment and money to go into it, so there needs to be a you know what I'm saying? Like
I don't completely.
yeah, it's not cheap to license movies, let's say that. But it's the upside is if they sell, then yeah, we'll see what happens. I don't want to jinx anything. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be great, so I'm not jinxing it, but I guess we'll just see. We'll just see.
I guess keep talking to you, but we can like close this out with stuff you want to promote, tell people all your websites and handles and all that stuff. So if anyone ends up listening to this, they know where to find out more.
Yeah, sure, man. Yeah, so you go to refusefilms.com and there's like social media pages there that you can follow me on, or Refuse Liam. So Refuse Films, my company page, I guess you'd call it a company page, my production page, and then Refuse Liam is my personal page, but feel free to follow each one. And then yeah, if you want to email me, that's on the refusefilms.com. Just drop me an email if you want to ask any other questions or any advice or whatever it's worth, I'll be able to give you my experience, and then you make your own choice. So that's probably the best advice I can give. Whoever you listen to, always go your gut instinct. And if you fail, then you can learn from that. So that's also a learning experience.
Well, thanks for talking to me. And as usual, when I do these episodes, I've like learned a bunch of stuff that I can steal and apply to my own filmmaking
Please.
experience, which is what it's all about.
It's all about sharing the wealth and sharing the knowledge, and giving the keys to the kingdom, because there's so many gatekeepers. It's unbelievable. It's kind of shitty in a way, but to me it's all about giving back, and like I've made two independent films, very independent, very cheap, but I'd like to think that I've gone through a lot of the kind of shit first-time filmmakers have already gone through. So if I can try and navigate them, or give them advice, or tell them what a bad deal is, and tell them that they do have leverage, even though it feels like you don't, you do. It's always feel free to. And there's Facebook groups as well about predatory distributors and sales agents. It's always good to search for them, because it's always good, because it's usually the same companies that fuck over people. But yeah.
I think what you're saying is like it's going to be so easy if you've just made a film to get really excited that somebody wants to distribute it that you maybe don't look at it close enough. You're just like, oh my God, it was going to be DVDs and like,
Without doubt, yeah, because you're excited, because you've had this good festival run, and the distributors are really excited to sign you up, and oh my God, we're gonna do so much for this film, and really it's kind of bullshit, and you want to speak. I'm not saying all distributors like that, because not Troma are very, like with me, they've been very like realistic in terms of expectation. They've been, but they've to me, touch wood, no issue. Yeah, I'm happy, very happy. So we'll see, man. We'll see. I mean, even if people do sell to a distributor, always retain your other rights. Unless they're going to give you more money for the other rights, don't let everything go.
Yeah.
Especially keep some rights, keep some leverage on your movie. And also, another recommendation is never license your films out for longer than 2 or 3 years. Never, ever, ever. Because let's be honest, they're only going to promote and sell the movie for the first 2 or 3 years. It's like
Yeah.
watching a, it's like a film at the box office. All anyone cares about is the opening weekend. After that, it's
Right.
diminishing returns. It's like
Yep.
when a film gets released, there's so much product now, as they call it, that they're on to the next thing. So your thing ain't gonna
Yeah.
get attention for like 10 years. They just want it so that in case you make something in that meantime that breaks big, then hey, we can market it now, because this film's big and we've got their first film. That's the only reason to do it.
I like this whenever it happens, whenever an actor's first in anything that's a big hit, then all of these
That's
like
right.
TV movies where they've got like two lines creep out onto DVD with their face plastered on it, and it's kind
I
of hits.
mean, there were a time in England where you go to a supermarket and there'd be loads of DVDs with Danny Dyer's face on it, even though Danny Dyer's only in it for like 2 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
So it happens, you know?
All right, let's leave the recording there. Have a nice day, both listeners.